We have been working our way through Matthew 24. We've been looking at the major messages of Jesus, looking particularly at the Sermon on the Mount, and then the Olivet Discourse, and down the road, the Upper Room Discourse. I want to right now start off with looking at the text, because we want to review a little bit to get some context, so that we're kind of on the same page. We've had a couple of weeks of interruption in our course of study due to the events of Palm Sunday and Easter that we have celebrated. So looking at Matthew 24, beginning at verse 15, we read, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. Let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, and pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, 'Look, he is in the desert,' do not go out, or 'Look, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. And wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together." And then verse 29 is our text for today. "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other." Now, there's a lot of stuff in this text, and it has not always been well understood. And so we've wanted to go back through and sort of look at this. I want to review a little bit from some of the previous times that we have looked at the text, and just a couple of observations relative to the Sermon on the Mount and the Olivet Discourse. In both of these, Jesus has a kingdom focus that he is communicating. And Jesus is talking to the Jews about Jewish prophecy and the kingdom. That is the immediate context that he has in view here. And we also noted that the Olivet Discourse is not about the church. It's not about church-age believers. It's focused on the Jews and what is going to happen relative to them in the future. The next big event for the Jews after the church departs is the tribulation period. When we look at all of the scripture and put it all together, that is how we see it coming together. The Olivet Discourse answers practical questions on future events. There was an initial limited reception associated with the triumphal entry. There was rejection that followed that in terms of the religious leaders reacting to Jesus. And then there was a pronouncement a pronouncement of woes against the leaders, the scribes and the Pharisees in particular. There was a lament relative to Jerusalem and what was going to happen, and then there was a prediction about what was going to happen, particularly focused on the temple. And these were real, specific, literal events and details that were noted there. And then there was the question that the disciples had relative to Jesus saying that this temple is going to be destroyed. And they said, well, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And we had noted that the destruction of the temple, as Jesus had predicted, took place literally in 70 AD. But the coming of Christ and the end of the age would be yet future. So there were things that were yet going to take place in a future time. And Jesus references a time frame from the book of Daniel, from the prophecy that Daniel had given. And we had noted that when we look at chapter 24, verses 4 through 8, that relates to the first half of this period of tribulation, referenced as the beginning of sorrows. Verses 9 through 14 relate to the second half of the tribulation period, where it says, then the end will come. And then verses 15 through 22 relate to how to deal with this period of tribulation if you find yourself in it, if you are living at that time. And then in verse 15, there's the reference to the abomination of desolation, which is a defining event relating back to the book of Daniel. And so we had noted that Daniel 9, 24 to 27 gives us a time frame for understanding the future. And it references a time frame of 70 weeks of years. And we had noted that it's literally 70 sevens, and the sevens is associated with a week in terms of a week is 7 days. But it's years when you start looking at it in its context. And we had looked at the reference at the beginning of the book of, or at the beginning of chapter 9 of Daniel, that was the years, 70 years was on the mind of Daniel when he was asking the question relative to when they were going to be restored after the Babylonian captivity. So then there's a distinguishment made, 69 weeks from a particular command until the Messiah comes. And we had noted that is identified as 3 or March the 3rd of 444 BC until March the 30th of AD 33, when this command was given relative to the restoration of things in Jerusalem until the Messiah is cut off, and relating to the time frame associated with the triumphal entry. And then the 70th week is separated by the church age. We have a distinction that's made here. And so I'm not going to go into more detail on that just now, or we'll be stuck here all morning. The 70th week is in two parts. We noted 3.5 years and 3.5 years. And it's divided by the abomination of desolation, referenced in Matthew 24:15, but also in Daniel chapter 9. And that's recognized as the tribulation period. And then we had also looked just briefly, and if you're toward the back, you'll have a hard time seeing this. This is just a visual outline of what we have referenced. The 69 weeks, reference 69 sevens, is 483 years. It's divided 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The first 49 years relates to the rebuilding of Jerusalem, and the 62 weeks or 62 sevens relates to 434 years, or the period of time leading up to the Messiah, when the Messiah is cut off right there. And then we have the church age in between, and then that final week of years, the 7 years, is associated with the tribulation period, or Daniel's 70th week. And then just another graphic of that we have previously shown. Again, this 69 weeks relating to March 5th, 444 BC, and then the Messiah, the Prince. This is the decree to restore. This is March 30th, AD 33, and associated with the triumphal entry. Luke 19, 25 to 40, I think it says, 28 to 40. And so then we have the coming prince referenced in the book of Daniel, and then the Messiah's return and we have the abomination of desolation that divides this period of time. So just a reminder there. So both Daniel and Revelation give details relative to the timing and the personnel, and we have noted that Matthew chapter 24 gives us some structure putting these things together, those things referenced in Daniel and those things referenced in the book of Revelation. And so we note there's a seven-year period with a distinct break in the middle. There's a recurring time frame referenced in Daniel and in Revelation in particular, looking at 3.5 years for one half, 3.5 years for the other, or 42 months, and also 1,260 days. And they all equal the same thing, different references. So it's not just a fluke. It's pretty obvious that there's something significant there. And then we also saw the identification of the little horn or the beast or the Antichrist that is referenced in many passages, but going back to Daniel in Revelation, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, and John, John's epistles as well. And so there's reference to an intensification of tribulation during this time and spiritual opposition and oppression. And then there is a note of urgency to flee when they see the abomination of desolation occurring, because it's going to be intensifying. And so those Jews that are living at that time, in particular focused on Judea, are urged to get out of there. And then there is a provision for God's people even then. His grace is evident in Revelation 12:6. It notes that there will be a place of provision for those that are seeking to escape at that time. So again, just looking at the details, the tribulation is referred to as the time of Jacob's trouble. There's reference to the coming prince, which is ultimately the Antichrist, the beast of Revelation, and then the Messiah returns at the end of this time frame of 7 years divided by the abomination of desolation. So that's just a quick overview of some of what we have looked at to give us some structure to see how these things are coming together. And then when we then come to looking at this text in Matthew 24:29, it says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And we note then there will be astronomical disturbances in the heavens, and it will be obvious, it will be significant, and it will have implications. But also in this text, we note there are time indicators that we want to recognize. There's reference to immediately after the tribulation of this time. So there will be this catastrophic darkness at the end of the tribulation. We had noted that there were events that would precede this, and we noted that those were associated with the seal judgment, the trumpet judgments, in Revelation 6 and Revelation 8 and 9, which are associated again with Matthew 24, 4 through 7. And then these events are preceded by the abomination of desolation and the great tribulation, or that time of even more intense tribulation that comes after, and that would be associated with the bowl judgments of Revelation 16. So again, we're trying to look at all of the text, putting them together, seeing how they correspond. And then we know that there seems to be a sequence of events when we see the words then that are noted. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds. That looks toward a literal physical event that is expected, and there is a time element that is included as well. There is relation to other biblical texts as well. So we see that there's various places in Scripture where it talks about great solar, lunar, and astral physical disturbances that are noted and recognized, where the sun is dark and the moon not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, powers of heaven will be shaken. We note these in the parallel passages in the Gospels, like Mark 13:24. But in those days after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, or the parallel passage in Luke 21:25, and there will be signs in the sun, in the moon, in the stars, and on the earth distress of nations with perplexity, and the sea and the waves roaring. And Joel also, in the book of Joel, he predicts such darkness associated with the DOL. Anybody know what the DOL is? Department of Labor? Day of the Lord, how about? Let's go with the Day of the Lord. Department of Labor, I don't think, was started back then. So it says, the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. And so we want to think about what is the nature of this day of the Lord and how is it associated with the events that we're looking at in Matthew 24. So there is identification of this event with the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord, this phrase occurs in 19 Old Testament passages with reference to special judgment that is anticipated. And this is somewhat of a general usage. There are other synonymous phrases that refer to the same event. They are referred to as that day or the day or the great day of the Lord, Zephaniah 1:14, or the day of God, 2 Peter 3:12, and Revelation 16:14. So there is a correspondence and a delineation of these different terms relative to the same event. The day of the Lord also has a more specific meaning, and it's primarily used of the final climactic time when Satan and the enemies of God are judged, and that will be in real time and space. And it also relates to the establishment of the kingdom that is predicted, the kingdom that Christ is going to be the one who reigns on. That's the whole idea of the Messiah, is the anointed one who is going to be king of something, and it's that kingdom that the scriptures speak of throughout. The day of the Lord refers to God's special interventions into the course of world events, and that usually involves judgment of his enemies, the accomplishment of his purpose for history. It involves demonstrating that he is the sovereign God of the universe. That is all part of what is communicated in this. And the day of the Lord, the future day of the Lord, will be a time of universal judgment on the arrogant human race who have opposed God and his people, Israel, and they will be a reality. And many passages reference this. Isaiah 2, Isaiah 34, Obadiah 15, which we'll look at momentarily. And many others, but I'm not going to go into all of those at the moment. Obadiah described judgment on all the nations and restoration of Israel, where we read, for the day of the Lord upon all the nations is near. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your reprisal shall return upon your own head. For as you drank on my holy mountain, so shall all the nations drink continually. Yes, they shall drink and swallow, and they shall be as though they had never been. And it's kind of the idea of drinking judgment to themselves. But on Mount Zion there shall be deliverance, and that's associated with the Jews, with Israel. There shall be holiness. The house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. So there's this continuing theme in Scripture of there is judgment. There was even judgment on Israel, but there will also be deliverance. There will be a restoration. There will be a remnant of Israel. And that is anticipated relative to the kingdom that is coming, that has been predicted of which Christ is the anointed one who will be the king. In verse 21 of Obadiah, it says, then saviors or deliverers shall come out, shall come to Mount Zion to judge the mountains of Esau, those around them, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. Again, there's this reference to the kingdom. Joel indicates the cosmic changes around the return of Christ, and that that is the day of the Lord. In verse 11 of chapter 2, it says, the Lord gives voice before his army, for his camp is very great, for strong is the one who executes his word. For the day of the Lord is great and very terrible. Who can endure it? And then verse 31, the sun shall be dark, shall be turned into darkness, and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. So we have a parallel here to what we saw in Matthew chapter 24. So there are some implications then regarding the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord doctrine is a reminder that sin and evil will not go unpunished. It will be a time of unimaginable terror in the souls of men because it's a judgment that is coming. But there's two parts of that. There is a judgment on evil and the wicked, but there will be an inception of the kingdom that the nation Israel has been predicted will be coming, and they will be a part of that, those who survive through that tribulation period. Isaiah 2 seems to correlate with the sixth seal judgment that relates to earthquakes and that sort of thing. So there's another connection there and associated with the day of the Lord. What we also want to recognize is that there appears to be several distinct times of such cosmic signs in the heavens. There seems to be more, when we look at all of the different scriptures, there seems to be more than one event, all of which are associated with the tribulation period, but there seems to be various elements of it and almost an intensification as it goes along. So there seems to be more than just one element of that. Isaiah 2:19 says, they shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth from the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake the earth mightily. And if you remember when we went back through Matthew 24, some of the text there was talking about going and hiding in the places in the earth, and this is associated with that as well. And there's a reference to earthquakes, which also there was back in verses 4 through 8 of Matthew 24. And then Revelation 6, 12 through 14 says, and I looked when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair. The moon became like blood. The stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig drops its late figs when it is shaken by a mighty wind. Then the sky receded as a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place. And then look back to Isaiah 34, 4 to 5, and I'm not projecting these because I'm wanting to kind of press on. All the host of heaven shall be dissolved, the heavens shall be rolled up like a scroll. Same imagery. All their hosts shall fall down as the leaf falls from the vine, and so on. And it references again in that passage judgment. The fourth judgment seal also deals with this kind of phenomenon. Revelation 8:12. Then the fourth angel sounded, and the third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, a third of the stars, so that a third of them were darkened. A third of the day did not shine, and likewise the night. Now this is earlier in the tribulation period, not at the very end before Christ comes back, and where it's a reference to almost a total darkness. And then there's also some reference to the sun being darkened later or in between in the tribulation period. Isaiah 13:10, for the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth. The moon will not cause its light to shine. And Isaiah 13 has a couple of other comparable references. So what do we learn from these passages? Well, there will be severe judgment on the earth, and that will include not only the national things, the physiological things taking place on the earth, and there will be plenty of that, but there also will be some astronomical kinds of things that are things that are going on out there. That we've referenced, Joel 3, the sun and moon will grow dark and the stars will diminish their brightness and so on. But what we want to note is there seems to be more than one occasion in this seven-year period where this seems to be the case. And the exact nature of that is not obvious, but it sounds like it's fairly substantial. But we also note that during this time there will be some shelter for Israel, whereas there will be distress on many others, and that is part of the picture that is communicated. So, moving on in the text, there will be a visible physical return of Christ. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. Then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And that's verse 30 of Matthew 24. So, some observations here. The title Son of Man has prophetic significance. It's used in Daniel, verses 13 and 14 of chapter 7, where we read, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, the one which shall not be destroyed. So this sounds like a reference to that which is associated with the Messiah, the anointed one, the king, and who is going to be of this kingdom. Now there's also other reference to this terminology, the Son of Man, especially associated with Ezekiel. There's other passages, not a huge number, but most of them are associated with Ezekiel, because that was the term that was used of him multiple times in the book of Ezekiel. Son of Man, stand on your feet, and I will speak to you. But it's also a designation that Jesus used to refer to himself. And there are many passages. Let me just note a couple. Matthew 8:20, Jesus said to him, foxes have holes and birds of the air have their nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. In Matthew 12:40, for as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. In the Olivet Discourse that we're looking at, Matthew 24 and 25, that designation is used seven times. Also, Jesus uses it in Matthew 26:4. You know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. So it's a common designation that Jesus used of himself, but the greater significance is when he used it before the Sanhedrin, and it was a title that they recognized immediately as referring to the anticipated Messiah. And it really, it gave them what they needed as a way of saying, oh, you've just blasphemed. But it's Matthew 26:64. Jesus said to him, it is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man, referring to himself, sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And so that stirred up, that gave the Sanhedrin what they needed to say, you've heard it yourself, he blasphemed. Also, interestingly, Stephen, before he died, he said, "Look, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." Sort of a confirmation of exactly what Jesus was saying. The references in Revelation are comparable to Daniel. Revelation 1:13, and I'm thinking back particularly of the verse that we looked at in chapter 7 of Daniel, verses 13 and 14. But you'll see this one here. It uses the same terminology. "One like the Son of Man, clothed in a garment down to his feet and girded," so on. And then I looked and behold, a white cloud. And on the cloud sat one like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown and in his hand a sharp sickle. So again, that terminology, it was seen by the Jews of that day as a technical designation of the anticipated Messiah. So that was what was in view. So the Son of Man can be a general term, as was used with Ezekiel and a few other places, but it was also recognized as a technical term, referencing the Messiah, the anticipated one that Christ clearly identified himself with. Then the location in heaven has spatial significance. And I was not jumping into a southern terminology there. Isn't that spatial? But it's having to do with space, something of that nature. His departure was real in real time. When Jesus left the earth in Acts, as noted in Acts 1:9, it says, "Now he had spoken." When he had spoken these things, while they watched, he was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight. So he left in real time, and he went up into the heavens and received by a cloud. His return was predicted in real time and space. Again, referencing Matthew 7:13 and 14, "I was watching the night visions. Behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven." That was predicted way prior to this, and also associated with his kingdom, as we had pointed out. And then also Acts 1:10 and 11 says, while they looked steadfastly toward heaven as he went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, who also said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will so come in like manner as you saw him go into heaven." That sounds like a pretty clear indication that we're talking a real-time literal physical return. And then the reference to on the clouds has significance as well. Let me note just a couple of passages here. Deuteronomy 33:26 says, "There is no one like the God of Jeshurun," and that was a sort of a poetic usage regarding Israel, and there's just a few places where that's used in Scripture. "Who rides the heavens to help you, and in his excellency on the clouds." Psalm 68:4, "Sing to God, sing praises to his name, extol him who rides on the clouds." And we saw it again in Matthew 24:30, "The Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven." And when Jesus was talking to the Sanhedrin, Matthew 24:64, he says, "Hereafter you'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Revelation 14:14-16, "Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and on the cloud sat one like the Son of Man," and referenced a couple other times in this passage, "him who sat on the cloud, him who sat on the cloud." So there's, as some would say, a cloud theme here. But there's a picture, there's an identification. So then the response of mourning has particular application to Israel. We saw in in verse 30 where it said, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with great power and glory. The tribes of the earth may be translated tribes of the land, and that seems to be able to be taken as associated with the tribes of Israel of the land, because Israel was associated with the land, and they would have had a particular relationship to this Messiah, and we recognize that the Messiah was rejected at the first coming. But that doesn't mean that God was done with Israel, because all of the passages indicate that there was yet more to consider. It also seems to indicate that every eye will see him, and some, most apparently Israel, will mourn. Revelation 1:7, "Behold, he is coming with clouds, and every eye will see him, even they who pierced him." And who would that be? That's the Jews. That's Israel. "And all the tribes of the earth will mourn because of him." If that tribes of the earth, tribes of the land, is referring to them, again it says all will see him, but who most specifically is focused on as likely would be the ones mourning. So that seems to be the case. I won't go to the wall on that one, but I think there's some possibility that that would be the case. There will be a separation and regathering of people. It says, "He will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other." And when we look at some of the various texts, we see angels will be involved in the final harvest. The angels are noted as the reapers in the final harvest. Matthew 13:39, where Jesus is explaining his parable, he says, "The enemy who sowed them, the seeds, is the devil," the seeds for the weeds. "The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels." The angels will separate the wicked from the just. Verse 49 of Matthew 13, "So it will be at the end of the age, the angels will come forth, separate the wicked from among the just." So again, that picture is communicated there. And the angels will accompany Christ in his return. Matthew 16:27 says, "For the Son of Man will come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he will reward each according to his works." Now, that rewarding there may be associated with the judgment seat of Christ relative to the rewards for believers. Look at verse 38 of Mark chapter 8. "For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him the Son of Man also will be ashamed when he comes in glory with his Father, with his old holy angels." And that sounds like it's more of a judging kind of emphasis. But nonetheless, the angels were part of that anticipated company that will be returning. The angels will be involved in preparing for the kingdom. They will be involved in eliminating the evil. Matthew 13:41, "The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and those who practice lawlessness." So that is one of the emphases. So that would be a preparatory kind of thing. They are involved in preparing subjects for the kingdom. Mark 13:27, "And then he will send his angels and gather together his elect from the four winds, from the farthest part of earth and or to the farthest parts or part of heaven." And we would just note here, the kingdom will include those who came to Christ during the tribulation, including Israel, and it will, and that would be on the earth, and it will include resurrected saints, those are of heaven. So you see both elements here, of the earth and of heaven, those who would come through the tribulation and those who are living on the earth and those who were coming from heaven, the resurrected saints coming back to earth on the kingdom in their resurrected glorified bodies, according to Scripture. So some concluding summary thoughts. The day of, I realized there was a lot there that we were trying to come through in a fairly quick period of time. So let's give a little bit of definition here. The Day of the Lord is a broad designation. It's directly related to the return of Christ. It is a defining judgment on the tribulation, rebellion, the rebellious ones during that period of time. It is preparatory to the inception of the kingdom. And it will have some accompanying features, such as being preceded by darkness. There will be a visible appearance of Christ. It will initiate mourning, particularly associated with the Jews, those who had pierced him, and includes the involvement of angels in the process as well. So, then there's the question. Will we face the Day of the Lord? Is that something that we can just put off and say, that doesn't relate to me, I don't have to worry about that? Or some think, well, it's already happened, or it'll be so far in the future that it won't relate to me, or how do I deal with this? Well, everyone has to be in one situation or another at some place and time and fit in most likely one of these four designations, either as an unsaved person who survives the tribulation with an expectation of judgment at the return of Christ. So that is one possible scenario, or as an unsaved person who does not survive but dies during that time but is judged in the great white throne judgment, Revelation chapter 20. Or one who is saved during the tribulation and survives to enter the kingdom, or may die prior to that and will then come back to reign as a resurrected saint, or as we note the last one, or as a redeemed and resurrected saint who returns with Christ to reign with him, looking at those texts that indicate that that will be the case with those who are believers, looking at 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, for instance. And so the question is, do you know how you expect to experience the Day of the Lord? Will it be in one form or another of this nature? So something to think about. How are we, or how am I, related to the anticipated return of Christ? Am I rightly related to Christ? Now is the question.